You are Locked On Pacers, your daily Indiana Pacers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
The last Locked On Pacers of 2019. Welcome into this Tuesday edition of the show. Big day today. They play the 76ers in town. As always, I am one of the hosts of this lovely podcast, Tony East, covering the Pacers for Forbes, the West Indianapolis Commuter News, and the Fieldhouse. Of course, the 76ers, we did not have someone come talk about them the first time these two teams played. Great game. But we will this time, because this is a huge game for both teams, both shockingly on a two-game losing streak. So with me on the other line, Sixers Adam Aronson. You may know him from many places, but probably Twitter. Former Liberty Ballers writer with big moves coming. Adam, how are you, man?
Pretty good. How about you?
It's weird referring to a different Adam. I am great. I am very excited for this game, and I am happy to be done traveling for the holidays. And I hope you had not stressful travel.
I did not. I did not travel much at all during the holidays this
year. Well, look at you. We can't all win them. So I have to ask you about a random player first. It's not really random, but I consider it random. The first time these two teams played, Furkan Korkmaz started because Josh Richardson was out. And now Josh Richardson will be back. So talk to me about Josh Richardson and how big of an impact he's had on the Sixers this season.
The interesting thing with Josh Richardson, I don't think that people in the Sixers universe really picked up on this until we actually saw it happen, is he's basically the primary ball handler late in close games, because they don't want to put the ball in Ben Simmons' hand, especially, you know, if they're up 3 points with a minute left and Ben Simmons brings the ball up. The other team's going to intentionally foul him, and he's shooting close to 50% from the line this year. So Richardson is actually, you know, when you think of Josh Richardson, at least for me, you think of him first as a defense guy, but his offense has been just as important for this team, and it's still a work in progress. They tried to have him be the backup point guard at the beginning of the year. He just didn't show the necessary skills to pull that off. He's still clearly trying to figure out a two-man game with Embiid, something like what J.J. Redick had with him. So again, a work in progress, but Richardson's he's so much fun to watch, just because you know he's never going to take a night off. He's always playing hard. His defense is outstanding. Great, great two-way player, as I think most people already know. A ton of fun to watch. Still got some stuff that he has to figure out in the context of the rest of this team. It's not really a team that makes a ton of sense for him offensively, just because they've got two bigs and then they have a big initiator who doesn't shoot, and none of it really makes sense with this team offensively. And really, you could say that everybody is still trying to work it out. But Richardson, great player. He's had a good year, and I would imagine he's going to improve as the year goes on and he gets more familiar with his surroundings.
Another reason to me that he adds so much intrigue, and obviously we get to the big names that have all the intrigue in a second, but with him not playing the first time, Korkmaz is not a good defender at all, especially in comparison to Richardson, and that Jeremy Lamb has 15 points on 9 shots, and TJ Warren picks on Tobias Harris to the tune of 29 points. It felt like he didn't miss at all until the fourth quarter. One of those options is gone now. You're really reliant on the Harris matchup for your bailout shots at the end of shot clocks with Richardson back. And that really limits what you can do, and the defense kind of knows where the ball is going to go. And I think that Richardson being back is going to tremendously upgrade what seems like a minor upgrade from one guy to the next.
Yeah, I mean, this defense really, when they're clicking, it's kind of ridiculous the way that they play. I mean, you look at Harris as the weak link, but I wouldn't even consider him a weak link. He certainly isn't a plus defensively, but he's gotten much better moving laterally. He's done a good job switching onto smaller guards. He's strong enough to survive against most bigs. He guarded Marc Gasol for most of the Raptors series last year, basically games 2 through 7. So he's not perfect, and he still gets beat off ball a lot. He has trouble navigating through screens. But overall, when you look at the starting five, the defense is incredible. And it's something I said before the season, I thought they would have the best defense in the NBA by far. And it turns out that could be said for Milwaukee, at least so far this year. But, which is terrifying considering what they have on offense. But But yeah, this defense is awesome, and Richardson's a big reason why, because like you said, even if it was Simmons and Embiid and Horford and Harris and Korkmaz, that's still a pretty good unit. You have Embiid, Simmons, and Horford, who are three very high-level defenders, and one weak link, and then kind of an average guy. And then you turn the weak link into a clear positive. Like, Richardson is probably not quite an all-defense caliber player, but he's on the borderline. He's at the very least a clear positive. So he's helped a lot, helped transition this defense into a better version of what it was last year, where they often struggled against smaller guards.
Yeah, they're really good on that end. And last year, of course, for the Pacers, the struggle against the Sixers was they just have size everywhere. And Darren Collison is tiny, and Corey Joseph is tiny, and Vic, for how great he is tiny. The Pacers get over that hump a little bit now with Brogdon being their tiniest guy, but the Sixers' defense is better. So one step forward, two steps back, it feels like. All right, the big guy, Joel Embiid. Adam, I'm really annoyed that he shot 15 for 15 from the foul line in that first
game. I'll just cut off real quick and say, in preparation for this, I looked up his career stats against the Pacers. In 9 games, he has attempted 90 free throws against the Pacers.
Yeah, Caitlin Cooper had to spend the last days of her 2019 writing about Turner's coverages on Embiid because it has not gone well. Miles Turner has horrible games against the Sixers time in and time out, and it changes the discourse around him every time, and it's so frustrating. And I get why, because you want him to play well against the best centers, but yeah, Joel Embiid just totally owns him every time, and Turner fouls him a million times. And yeah, I'm assuming you were looking at this first game and you were doing research, and I look at it, and it's not the story of the game. There were tons of stuff that happened. It was a great game wire to wire, but like, Goga had to play, and they weren't planning on playing Goga because of foul trouble. And like, who knows what happens? They only got outscored by one, but who knows what happens in those 5 minutes if they don't have to play Goga. So it's very important for Turner to not foul, one, because Embiid can hit 15 free throws. He's actually had 2 games this year making over 15 and taking over 15 in the same game. The other one was the Jazz. That was my pre-podcast research. But two, he can stay in the game, and that's helpful even if Embiid is scoring on him. He can space the floor and hit shots, which he didn't do the first time, but he can do it. We know he can.
Yeah. I would harp on the idea of spacing the floor. I would imagine that when the two starting units are in, Embiid will guard Sabonis and Horford.
Yep.
Will
guard they? Really? Wait. I said yep so hastily. Really? Because I did not think so.
I do, especially because, I mean, even looking back at
you would know last better.
Year before, when the Sixers would throw somebody else on Miles Turner and have Embiid guard Thad Young, they like to keep him as close to the paint as they can. It's also similar to having him on Pascal Siakam instead of Marc Gasol in the Toronto series.
Right.
You might be right, and they might not do that, and they could just throw a bunch of different looks. But in general, when Embiid is on Turner, because he definitely will be at some times in the game, it's huge that Turner is able to space the floor, step out, and hit an open three. Because Embiid, especially in the regular season where at times he's coasting, he will let the opposing big have an open 18-footer, and he'll let the opposing big have an open three. Basically all the time. It takes a lot for him to run out and contest those. That's part of – they run a dropping scheme against pick and roll anyways, so he just is generally inclined to stay in the paint. So if Turner can start knocking down some open looks, that would be huge.
Yeah, you can't go on for it again. I'm going to go back to the Horford-Embiid matchup thing. I only said what I thought, that Horford would be on Sabonis and Embiid on Turner, because Horford has been the Sabonis antidote for 2 straight seasons. Like last year in the playoffs, it was unbelievable how much Horford just had every Sabonis number checked. And of course, I was on a different team, but that just resonates so strongly with me that I wonder if they'll go back to it. But I understand what you're saying. Both sides make sense.
Yeah, I would imagine it. I would imagine they'll throw a bunch of different looks at both of those guys. And I remember coming on here when we talked about TJ McConnell over the summer and talking about how funny it was that the Sixers had Horford to match Sabonis and Embiid to match Turner, and it was like the worst case scenario for both of those guys.
It sure was. Ah, TJ McConnell. I thought he was so bad for about 2 weeks, and now I've thought he's so good almost every game since. What a turnaround.
I'm glad to see he's playing well. It really is, like, when he's a guy where when he's not playing well, it's, like, so aggravating, and, like, how is this guy a rotation player in the NBA? And then when he's doing stuff well, you would, like, trust your life with him.
I know. It's crazy. And he takes one or two fadeaways from the block every game, and I hate both of them. And he somehow makes just enough of them that he keeps taking them, and it's fine.
I believe last year and the year before, he was like top three in the NBA in field goal percentage for mid range. It's not a good shot, and it doesn't look like a good shot, but he makes it like a pretty crazy amount.
What we've talked about with him on this show before a lot is like, obviously single game plus minus is a junk stat. But he is the guy that, like, if his is bad, it's usually so reflective of how he actually played, right? He just drags everybody down so much when he's bad, but he's, like, such a good prop when he's good. It's so interesting.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that, and especially when he was here, and now we're, like, a little bit too far off on a tangent, but when he played with Ben Simmons, it was a disaster every time because neither of them shoot threes, and, like, they both needed the ball. And every time they played together, his plus minus would be horrible. So yeah, I definitely get where you're coming from with that.
How dare you harp on Simmons' three? He's a 40% 3-point shooter.
It's a good point.
All right, we'll get to Simmons in a second, but I need to flip the script here. Your turn, because we know that Embiid's going to own Turner and possibly Sabonis as well, and we know Josh Richardson's going to change the calculus of how the Sixers defend. What are the Sixers going to be afraid of in this game?
Ooh, Malcolm Brogdon is the most obvious one to me.
Yep.
Just because generally small guards have done well against the Sixers in the past, not as much this year as last year. And Brogdon did play well last time these two teams played. I think he had
tremendous. 20. Yeah.
And also there are hundreds of Sixers fans who are currently flying to Indianapolis to boo Malcolm Brogdon for winning the Rookie of the Year award 3 years. And if I know Sixers fans the way I know Sixers fans and what happens to Sixers fans, Brogdon will definitely drop 30 just to quiet down the hundreds of Rights to Ricky Sanchez listeners who will be in Indianapolis.
That's funny. I did not know that was a thing. That was so ridiculous. Like, Embiid was clearly better.
Yeah, so they went to Milwaukee last year, 2 years ago, and Malcolm Brogdon did not play. So they booed Tony Snow for the entire game as Foxy. And Doris Burke was so confused on the broadcast. It was incredible. If you see a section of loud and weird Sixers fans tomorrow, you probably will notice it at some point.
I did not know that. That's awesome.
That's what's going on there. Yeah, they're there to cheer on TJ, and also, as a bonus, they get to boo Malcolm Brogdon finally.
That's awesome. Yeah, he was really good in the first game. And what really impressed me, and this has been a Pacers problem all season long, and I know that the Sixers are kind of foul happy this year, if I recall. Defensively,
they play really physical.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a better way of putting it. I liked my negative spin on it, but yes, you can say that. He got 8 free throws up, and he never misses free throws, so that was a big deal. But yeah, 28 points on 15 shots is a great game, and he paired it with passing. You know, he and TJ Warren, I felt like when they were in the game, the Pacers could get whatever they want outside of the last 45 seconds of the game. So I agree that he's the guy that I've circled as need bucket, give to this guy, because as good as Simmons is and as good as these guard defenders are, I think the speed he has, he's not fast, but you know, he can be shifty enough to create something, and we saw that the first time.
Yeah, I agree. Brogdon's obviously a very good player. He's, you know, been an all-star caliber player, or if not close to it. It wouldn't surprise me if TJ Warren played well again. Maybe it's recency bias to some extent, but he just seems like such a Sixers killer. Like, if you follow the Sixers, if there are any Sixers fans listening to this, you'll know exactly what I mean. Like, there are just certain guys where you look at them and you're like, that guy's a Sixers killer. And TJ Warren has always been one of those. And, you know, it helps my argument that he scored 29 points and shot 4-4 from 3 last time they played. But either of those two, I think those would be my key matchups if I'm the Sixers.
The guys who killed it the first time?
Yeah.
Good, probably two good choices. I have another thing that I am intrigued by in this game from the first time. So Justin Holliday was 4 for 5. Doug McDermott was 3 for 4. Aaron Holiday was 2 for 3. And TJ McConnell was 3 for 5. The worst Pacers bench player was 60% shooting the first time these guys played. That's not going to maintain. That's just not. That's not feasible at all. And I know Thibel was out, correct?
Thibel, are you talking about the first game?
He will not be playing in this game, right?
Thibel will not be playing tomorrow.
Right. So that helps. That kicks out some defense, although Josh Richardson is back. But I think the Pacers bench is going to have to find a way to be really good again, but they're not going to shoot as well. So I think they might have to step up defensively, and that's going to be hard because Brett Brown's pretty good at mixing and matching lineups. So I do worry a bit more about those minutes in this game, even though I don't think the Sixers bench is particularly awesome.
Yeah, I mean, their bench isn't awesome. It's, you know, I think I've used the phrase work in progress a few times, and I think it can use that for a lot of different aspects of this team, and that includes the bench. They're definitely better than last season where they legitimately had two players on their entire bench who were definitely NBA players, and the rest of them were like a bunch of like 6'11 centers who can't move from side to side. shout out to Greg Monroe and Boban Marjanovic and Amir Johnson. But yeah, I mean, it's not a finished product, and they've got 6 weeks now to bolster it, and I suspect they will. They've got a war chest of second round picks, thanks to Sam Hinkie, that they can work with. But yeah, I mean, you look at James Ennis has played well recently. So has Furkan Korkmaz. They've both kind of stepped up since Thibel has been out and taken the lion's share of the bench wing minutes. Trey Burke has done a nice job off the bench, adding some scoring punch. A lot of Sixers people were expecting that of him for a while, and he seems to have finally figured out what his role can be within this team. Mike Scott, you kind of know what he is. He's going to shoot if he's open for three. They really need that because they have a lot of guys who aren't decisive. And yeah, I mean, you look at someone like Raul Neto, who hasn't played much because Burke has emerged. It's a lot of guys where you're like, okay, I'd be fine with him as my 8th or 9th guy. And there are a lot of guys who right now are kind of underqualified for the minutes they have. And then you have some guys who are actually overqualified. So it's kind of a nice problem to have. And they'll work on it more over the next 5 or 6 weeks until the trade deadline. But to get back to your original point, I think the Pacers are definitely going to need to outplay the Sixers bench again. And I'm not sure where that production is going to come from. I don't know if it's going to be TJ, because everybody from the Sixers trip is going to be cheering him on, even though he's playing against the Sixers. And if Jakar Sampson plays, they'll be cheering him on too.
Process legend, correct?
Yeah, oh, yes. Like one of the all-time process legends.
That's fantastic.
But yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's a work in progress, as I keep saying. It's an okay bench, not great. Not exactly as good as what you want when you're trying to win a championship. For now, it's okay. It's good enough. And they'll work on it in the future.
I know no Sixers fan wants to give up Zaire, but I feel like Zaire for the final piece seems like the thing that will happen. I know this isn't Pacers related. I'm just
Especially because what the Sixers really should have done is overpay TJ on a 1-year deal with a non guaranteed second year, so they could use him as salary filler in a trade. But they didn't, so they barely have any medium sized salaries. They have Mike Scott at 4.7, but it's kind of counterproductive to move him unless you're making a huge upgrade, because then you're losing your most willing spot up shooter.
Right.
And you have Zaire at, I think, 3.5. And unless you're packaging together like 3 or 4 minimums, which is pretty hard to pull off, if they want to make any sort of serious upgrade, they might have to include Zaire.
All right. Let's talk Ben Simmons now. I know I've kind of been all over the place, but I didn't have a script. I just had things I wanted to talk about, and I'm going through them. Ben Simmons is one of the things to talk about because he's Ben freaking Simmons. I think Ben Simmons is amazing, which it seems like a far-fetched thought on the internet these days, but his lows seem to get the discourse around him moving so fast and like that he doesn't fit with this guy, trade him, and it just blows my mind, and I want to know how the Pacers can make him have one of those games where he's so bad that the Sixers conglomerate on the internet wants to trade him immediately.
Yeah, so it's interesting because last year it would be like a lackluster performance on offense and everybody would be frustrated, especially because he kind of coasted defensively last year in the regular season. Now he's like, he's been the best defensive player on the team, on a team that has Joel Embiid on it.
And Al Horford.
Yeah, and he's going to make an all-defense team. And like, it wouldn't even surprise me if he gets Defensive Player of the Year votes at this point with how well he's played. So it's not as simple anymore as just like having a bad offensive game, because no matter what, basically, the defensive production is going to be there. As far as what the Pacers can do, I mean, really, it's kind of just, you know, if you can cut off his driving lanes, make him give up the ball and not go get going downhill towards the rim, that's really your best bet with a player as smart and with the physical tools that he has, because there are just not many players who are as tall as him, as athletic as him, and as smart as him. It's kind of hard to limit.
Any?
I don't know. I mean, is Giannis maybe?
LeBron. Yeah.
But LeBron's not as quick as Ben is anymore.
Right. Yeah, Giannis is one. You're right.
Yeah.
I think I don't know. I IQ made me maybe think differently, but
yes.
And, both those guys. Yes.
Yeah. It's a very limited group that are even, you know, in that same realm with all three of those traits. And that's part of what makes him a good defender. But back to the offense, I would say if you can prevent him from getting to the rim at will, especially like if you can intimidate him to some extent, and he'll never, like, he's pretty good at hiding when he's intimidated, but I think the opposing team can probably tell when, like, he passes up like a 10-foot jumper and then ends up shooting like an awkward 8-foot hook shot. Like, I think you could tell at that point that you've gotten in his head a little bit, or that he's gotten in his own head. So I think that's what you should be looking for. He's been noticeably more aggressive over the last month. Before the month of December, he was averaging 12.9 points per game, and since then he's averaging 16.4.
Oh, good.
His shooting has gone up 7%. His field goal percentage has gone up almost 10%. So he's definitely making strides offensively this year. He had kind of taken a step back at the start of the year. So nice to see that he's getting better. I'm just not sure who on the Pacers is doing all of those things that I said. Like, is TJ Warren going to be able to stick with him and stay in front of him and cut him off on drives throughout a game? I'm not sold on that.
No, you shouldn't be sold on that.
Right. And you know, I think they tried to at least some amount putting Brogdon on him in the last game. Maybe I'm misremembering, but even
a little bit, yes.
Even Brogdon, who does a great job guarding above his size, Simmons is so much taller than him. He can just post him up, and Ben isn't a great post player, but Ben can easily post him up at the elbow and get off a little hook right over him, or just get downhill and go to the basket and draw a foul. And part of that is, you know, Ben has to be willing to draw fouls. He often shies away from contact because he doesn't want to shoot free throws, because everybody knows he's not a good free throw shooter. So there's a tough balance to strike there for him that he's still working on. And there are some confidence issues, I think, happening. But, you know, overall, kind of exactly what I just outlined about cutting him off on drives and doing things like that. But I'm not sure the Pacers have anybody who's equipped to do that.
I think Brogdon will play on him mostly. I think Lamb will guard. I think it'll be straight positions from the Pacers basically on defense. But you just said his free throw shooting is not good. I recall him going 7-for-7 in a complete miracle in a 3-point Sixers win. So we were talking on our Monday show, looking ahead at the week. Actually, that was yesterday's show for the listeners here. If the Sixers had shot their season free throw percentage in that first game, they made 5 less free throws. They were on fire from the line.
Yeah, they shot, what, 32 of 36 from the line?
Yes. I mean,
32 of 36 from the line.
They would have made 27 of 36 if they shot their season percentage.
Yeah, I mean,
They did it. They, like, this isn't like some bad luck thing. It just,
yeah. Embiid is notably a very good free throw shooter, but still, anytime you get, basically, Brogdon's the only one who you can get 15 out of 15 from the line from and not think that it's a fluke to some extent.
Yeah.
But when you get that and you get 7 of 7 from Simmons, which Ben, you have to check, but I'm pretty confident saying is the most free throws he's ever made in a game without a miss. And I would imagine it's not even close.
well, that makes me feel
but yeah, for sure, that was definitely fluky. And even, you know, the Sixers shooting 47.8% from three, but also the Pacers shot 50% from three. So there's always, you know, that's just
the that was game. The weirdest game.
Yeah, it was a weird
like,
game.
Nobody could miss, and then all of a sudden the Pacers just forgot what they were doing for 45 seconds, and they lost, and that was it.
Yeah, and then Ben Simmons just, like, gets three steals late in the game.
That was part of them forgetting what they were doing, is I think they thought that Ben Simmons was on their team because he did blow up the one play all by himself. Well, not all by himself, but they switched the whole set when the Pacers had it tied, and he just destroyed it. And then the other steals, he was just everywhere, and he was insane at the end of that game.
Yeah, Ben, I just talked about it for a little bit earlier, so I'll just make a quick point. The consistency with which he is locked in defensively is really impressive, because I think everybody kind of knew, even when he wasn't a good defender at LSU, at least I thought it was pretty clear, like, if this guy wants to be a good defender, he will be. He's just too smart and athletic and big not to. But now it's like, you just watch, like, he plays in Washington and he does a great job on Bradley Beal, and then they play the Raptors and he's guarding Pascal Siakam. And then he plays great defense against Jimmy Butler in three different games. And I'm really not sure who is as versatile defensively as him. You know, maybe somebody like Giannis, who basically is part of every conversation like this. But, yeah, Simmons defensively, and I think he kind of blossomed with it in the Pacers game, and that might have been a launching point for him. He's really been
– Oh, good. Yeah, he is amazing. And it makes me very sad when I see a lot of people saying, oh, he doesn't fit with Joel Embiid. I'm like, well, maybe kind of, but like, he's too good for it to matter. He's just too good for it to matter.
Yeah, people, if I could just touch on that real quick. People, especially in the Sixers world, are obsessed with the word fit. It's always about who fits best with the rest of the team, and it's never about who the best player is. And there are some significant issues with Simmons and Embiid comparing, and specifically with what happens with Simmons in a playoff game, especially now that Jimmy Butler's gone and you don't really have a go-to ball handler, and now they're asking Richardson to be that. But I don't think people ever just, like, sit back and think, like, okay, Ben Simmons is 23 years old. He's a surefire all-star. He guards at least 4.5 positions at an excellent level. He's averaging, what, 15, 8, and 8 or something in that territory. He's an incredible player for his age and experience level. Even if there are some important issues that should be discussed, it should also be mentioned that he's an awesome player.
An amazing player. Let's transition to the better Sixers guard, Furkan Korkmaz. Just kidding.
Nice.
So Christmas Day, caught a lot of Raptors Celtics in the morning. Then I did some stuff with my family, and I flip on Sixers Bucks near the end of the third quarter. And Korkmaz made like 7 threes in a row. It wasn't actually that, but it felt like it. They were just in. And I get that the Bucks defensive scheme was let him be open, but he was just nailing everything. And you actually surmised before the season that he would be useful this year after not at all being useful in seasons past. So why is Korkmaz all of a sudden this important rotation guy for the second best team in the conference? Because he has been terrible in the NBA before this year.
The reason is because the Sixers are starting a center at center, a center at power forward, a power forward at small forward, and a power forward at point guard. And Tobias Harris is the only player in their starting lineup who's an above average shooter. And he loves to catch the ball and then, instead of shooting, do a size up move, try to take his guy to the basket, pull up from 18 feet. On their bench, they have Matisse Thybulle, who somehow is shooting like 46% from three until he got hurt. It still doesn't make any sense to me, and I refuse to believe that it's going to last. But like James Ennis, who's like okay when he's open in the corner. It's really Korkmaz and Mike Scott are the only guys on this team who can just catch and let it rip. Brett Brown, in his pregame media availabilities during the preseason, he kept getting asked, you know, why is Korkmaz playing? Why is Korkmaz playing over Zaire Smith, who wasn't playing in the preseason? And Brett said he wanted to grow a bomber, which just means he wants somebody to come in and just let a bunch of threes rip. And Korkmaz does it. He's got a great pump fake. He's got a high release. He doesn't get blocked. He's 6'8". He's really, really tall. I think a lot taller than people realize. And he comes in and he just shoots threes. And And I'm still skeptical of whether or not he can play in the playoffs. He's made some strides defensively recently. In the Milwaukee game, he actually had three steals, and he got his hands on a bunch of different balls with deflections. So it's been a really good week for Korkmaz. He's had a few hot stretches and then a few cold stretches. He hit a game winner over Damian Lillard in Portland to seal a 21-point comeback in a quarter and a half.
Good Lord.
Yeah, and they've got him on a non-guaranteed minimum for next year.
That'll work.
Yeah, so I was not a fan of the signing when it happened. He was their fallback option after Kyle Korver chose Milwaukee over Philly. But all the reports from training camp were that he was playing well and Brett Brown was glowing about him. And in the preseason, it was clear that they needed somebody who could come in and shoot threes the way he does. So I think it's just, a combination of him getting better from year to year and also a confidence boost. He's a guy who clearly was not confident last year. He even requested a trade at one point when they didn't pick up his team option. And actually at his exit interview, he was like, yeah, I was the one who requested a trade and they traded everybody but me.
I remember that.
It was pretty funny. And it's hilarious that he ended up back with the team on a 2-year deal after all of that happened. But they gave him the confidence to just go out there and let it rip, and he's doing it, and he's a good shooter. So the shots are going in at a rate that is acceptable and is helpful for the offense. And we'll see if he can keep making strides defensively, maybe if he bulks up throughout the season, and we'll see how viable he is as a rotation player in the playoffs.
All right, on the spot, who breaks the 2-game win streak and ends their decade with a win?
I will say the Sixers. I don't like picking the Sixers. I generally stray away from it. Like when I went on Locked On Raptors with Sean Woodley, who's great, before the Sixers-Raptors series, he expected me to pick the Sixers, and I was like, I think the Raptors at five. So I try not to. I think I'm pretty good about being objective with this stuff, but I do think the Sixers are going to win. Just, the fact that Embiid dominates this matchup every time is just hard for me to get over. And it wouldn't shock me if the Pacers won. Really, nothing shocks me from game to game with the Sixers, who are just one of the weirdest things in the history of sports. But if I had to guess, I would say the Sixers win. It'll probably be a close game. They're two teams that are probably close to equally good. And I'll say the Sixers, but again, nothing would really shock me.
I think the Sixers as well. They just have always matched up well with the Pacers, and the Pacers, not gimmick, that's not the right word, but the Pacers two center thing works well against a lot of teams. The Sixers is not one of them. And they still have Ben Simmons as their extra wild card of matchup hell for the Pacers. So I think they have a shot, like you said. I think I think the Sixers are probably a half tier up, full tier up close to them. So they can win. They only beat them once last year, but I think the Sixers are better and they're a matchup mess. So tough end to 2019 for the Pacers, but it is what it is.
Yeah, they'll be fine. I mean, I guess I don't have to say that to you because you obviously follow more attention than I do, but I don't know. I look at their roster. It's a really good roster. They've got a bunch of players who, you can trust in an NBA game. And that does mean a lot more than I think people realize.
It does. It does. Adam, where can people follow you? And I would say your stuff, but you can't tell people that.
Yeah, so at Sixers Adam on Twitter, easy to remember. I'm bad at naming things. So, Sixers Adam. My name is Adam. I cover the Sixers. I will be writing very soon. Can't say where just yet. You'll find out in the coming days or weeks. We'll see. So follow me on Twitter for now, and you'll be able to see where I'm writing soon after.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. The rotation stuff you do. I always wanted to do that. That's a good idea.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you guys for listening. I'll probably do a show tomorrow just because I'll have time after the game before New Year's Eve stuff, because it's at 3 o'clock for some reason. Very weird. So enjoy your New Year's after the game. Be safe. And we will see you guys tomorrow.